September 13th, the Legislative Commission on Surrogacy, here in room 2412 at the Minnesota Senate Building. Today, first of all, I want to thank you all for coming, for those of you who are here, but we will have this on record so people can follow up if they choose to, and hopefully they will. Our agenda today is about the business practices of the fertility industry and clinics. So that's the people that we're hearing. You have the agenda in your packet. We also have the minutes from last month, August 30th, the 2015 meeting. So if anyone would offer a motion, Senator Dibble moves the approval of the minutes from the August 30 meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carried. Aye. So today what I wanted to just, there were two things that came to me on my emails regarding this topic as people are listening to what's going on or hearing what's going on. I got a letter from one of my constituents, and he pointed something out that I think that we have to remember. What he said here is, while some surrogacy arrangements have very good outcomes, we need to remember that we create laws and public policy to protect people from the worst case scenarios. So we know there are many good things that happen in this area, but there are some that are not, and that's what generally we will be looking at lawmaking. The other one, this one is one that I cut out a while ago. Donation results, this is a Dear Abby letter. 20 years ago, the gentleman was a sperm donor. He found out that he had nine
children.
And he said in here, and I don't expect that it's necessarily absolute truthfully, but I think it is, that there is a registry that lists children of donors. And this woman wrote and said that she knows of seven other siblings that he had. Now, this is an issue that I think would come up, especially if we talk about allowing children who are born through surrogacy to be looked at their genetic
field record.
Mm-hmm. So that was it was kind of funny, I think, in a way, but not. It's also, I think, pertinent to this topic that we're talking about. So today, with that, we're going to try to stick to a schedule. We have Jennifer Lull coming from the Center for Bioethics and Culture. She's on the phone today. We would like to keep your testimony, Jennifer, if you're listening here, to 20 minutes, and then maybe have time for questions from the commission, and so that we give each person an equal time or somewhat equal time. So with that, we'll start with Jennifer Lull, unless someone else has a comment they'd like to make. Please.
Madam Chair, I just got a text from Senator Benson, and she is trying to call in and evidently does not have the right number. Is there a number you can give me and I can get it to her?
Actually,
oh, you're on?
I apologize. I should have followed up. I did get the correct number.
Oh.
Thank you.
All right. You bet. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, welcome, Senator Benson. I think we have a quorum now. I'm glad you're all here. And Jennifer Lull, we'll listen to you. Do you have a comment?
No.
Okay. Jennifer Lull. Jennifer, you can go ahead now if you'd like to. Please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're coming from, and so forth.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay, great. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Minnesota Legislation. My name is Jennifer Lull, and I am the president of the Center for Bioethics and Culture based in the San Francisco Bay Area, and so I am calling from that area this morning. So thank you for hearing my testimony today. I've been asked to bring my expertise to clarify the medical and the psychological risks for surrogate mothers, and to process on what it takes for a surrogate woman to get pregnant. By way of a little bit of background on me, I did spend my first career in pediatric critical care nursing for nearly 20 years. I worked at the University of California, San Francisco, University of California, Los Angeles, and then Children's Hospital in Oakland, California for the last 10 years of my nursing career. I am published in nursing textbooks on maternal child health. For the last 16 years, after completing my graduate studies in bioethics, I founded and now run the Center for Bioethics and Culture, where one of our core issues is centered on the ethics of third-party assisted reproductive technology, and surrogacy and in vitro fertilization technology certainly depend on these more modern technologies that we have available to us today. On October 12th of 2015, my organization sent out a press release reporting on the death of a surrogate mother by the name of Brooke Brown. Brooke lived in Idaho and died on October 8th of 2015, and also the twin babies that she was carrying for a couple in Spain where surrogacy is illegal also died. Brooke was scheduled to deliver full-term twins by cesarean section just days before her death. When she and the babies died due to complications related to placental abruption, that's where the placenta just really literally abruptly tears away from the lining of the uterus, and Brooke and the babies died because of massive hemorrhage. Brooke was a wife. She also was a mother to three little sons, and she had been a surrogate mother to five babies at the time of her death. Dr. Michael Feynman, which is how I found out about the death, the fertility doctor, wrote on his fertility blog that pregnancy complications known as abruption of the placenta underscore the ethical problems when asking women to serve as surrogates for non-medical reasons, he wrote. To the family of this unfortunate woman, Brooke, the reason she was a surrogate does not matter right now. However, for those of us who defend the practice of compensated surrogacy in the United States, it is an important reminder that the practice should only be allowed for legitimate medical purposes. Dying from a pregnancy-related complication is so rare here in the United States that many people take it for granted and feel it is acceptable to transfer the risk of pregnancy to another woman. So in my mind, one of the key questions that I hope your committee will wrestle with is whether, as a matter of public policy, it's ethical to ask a young woman, and surrogates in the United States are overwhelmingly also young mothers who are responsible for the care and the well-being of their own children. So is it ethical to ask these young women to potentially jeopardize their own health by engaging in technologies with known risk to their health and the well-being of the babies that she's carrying? Is it ethical as a matter of public policy to ask her to do this for money? Unlike organ donors in the United States who are not compensated? And also, is it ethical to ask her to do it as an altruistic act, since pregnancy and childbearing is not medically indicated, it's not a life-saving medical procedure? Those who are proponents of surrogacy, whether commercial or altruistic, will tell you that pregnancy is safe and that these women suffer no additional health risks. But that's simply not the case in surrogacy and assisted reproductive technologies. And there is much in the medical literature that points to the health risk, not only to the women, but also to the babies they carry that are created in the laboratory through IVF. Out here in California, one of my colleagues, Dr. Alan Merritt, at the University of Loma Linda in Southern California, published a very important study that was put out in the World Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. And the title of their study was Outcomes of Surrogate Pregnancies in California and Hospital Economics of Surrogate Maternity and Newborn Care. His study looked at surrogacy in their institution, and their analysis of the 69 infants that were delivered from surrogacy between January 1st, 2012 and December 31st, 2013 found an increase in multiple births, an increase in neonatal intensive care unit admissions, a length of stay with hospital charges several multiple times beyond that of term infants conceived naturally and provided care in their nursery. Among the singletons and the twins surrogate pregnancies born in Loma Linda during that time period, the hospital charges were increased 26 times of a actually conceived baby. And in the case of triplets, the charges were increased 173 times out of a natural pregnancy when compared to just term infants provided in their nursery at Loma Linda. During the same time frame of their report from surrogate pregnancies, they reported that four infants had died soon after birth due to extreme prematurity, that there was also a fetal death in a twin pregnancy of a surrogate mom, and that the surviving infant was then classified as a singleton in their report. And then also among a triplet surrogate pregnancy, there was a fetal reduction, so that was reported as a twin. Women are at high-risk pregnancy centers in the case of Loma Linda and around the United States because of the health risk to these women and to the babies conceived this way. Why else would you find these babies in the neonatal intensive care unit and the moms in high-risk pregnancy centers if not for the health risk? A surrogate pregnancy is not the same as a natural pregnancy because these women, these mothers, have to take drugs to mimic how pregnancy just naturally normally occurs. To prepare the woman's uterine lining to receive an embryo that's going to be transferred. The drugs that are typically taken, the first one is Lupron. Lupron is a non-FDA-approved drug, not FDA-approved for this particular use. When Lupron first came on the market, it was approved for men in end-stage prostate cancer, and then later on it received FDA approval for endometriosis. But it's never been approved for the use in fertility medicine. But the purpose of Lupron is to synchronize surrogate mother's menstrual cycle, if you will, with the mother, the intended mother that she will be receiving the embryo from. There's one documented case in the medical literature, a case report of a gestational surrogate mother who was on Lupron being prepared for embryo transfer. That suffered increased intracranial pressure, putting her at risk for brain hemorrhage. In my work working with egg donors, we've had two egg donors who suffered strokes, and one was a direct result of the drug Lupron. So it's not a drug that is not without risk, and the only reason the woman is taking it is to just synchronize her cycle to prepare her uterus to receive an embryo. Two other drugs that the surrogate moms take are estrogen and progesterone, and again, that's to sort of mimic how a woman's uterus naturally prepares itself to become pregnant. And so we're trying to get this womb that's ready to receive an embryo, accept that embryo, implant that embryo, and hope that we'll have a live birth at the end. And then it's also common that these women will take steroids as an anti-immune system, so that they will also, again, receive this embryo that's being transferred into them. One surrogate mom who contacted me after the release of a documentary film that I did on surrogacy, which I screened several times in your state, her name is Julia, and she described her experiences to me when she took these hormones. She said she had to take the hormones for about 8 weeks, which is common, again, to allow the pregnancy to take. And she was hit hard with depression. She was not able to work for 5 weeks, and she was suicidal to the point where she had to be admitted to a psychiatric ward for 4 days. She refused to take the antidepressant medication, she told me, because she didn't want to harm the baby that she was carrying for the intended parents who had contracted with her for the pregnancy. So here's a case where a woman didn't look out for her own medical needs because she felt obligated to the baby that she was carrying by contract for a couple who had hired her. Women pregnant with foreign embryos, meaning this is not their own biological genetic child, since the DNA comes either from a donor egg or from the intended mother's egg, she's at a threefold risk of developing pregnancy-induced hypertension and preeclampsia, which also put not only her at risk, but the babies at risk. And what we're seeing in the medical literature that it's almost a reaction similar to if you think of organ donation, and why do we match organs from the organ donor to the organ recipient, is to prevent rejection. And so we're seeing in these pregnancies where these women are pregnant with foreign embryos or foreign genetic material, not from their own bodies, that their body is rejecting it. So that's placing them at risk for these pregnancy-induced hypertension and preeclampsia. Because these technologies are very expensive, the typical IVF take-home baby is the surrogate mother to be asked to carry twins or triplets. Last year in California, we had two very contentious surrogate cases with mothers carrying triplet pregnancies. One woman, they actually transferred three embryos and all three of the embryos implanted, so she became pregnant with triplets. And then the other surrogate mother, they implanted two embryos, and as embryos do, one of the embryo naturally twinned, which made her carrying three pregnancies. And both of these women became involved in pretty ugly legal disputes because the intended parents wanted them to reduce the pregnancies down to either singletons or to twins. So there's all the complications and risks to mother's health as well as the child's health when a woman is carrying a multiple babies. And of course, multiple babies almost overwhelmingly means cesarean section delivery. And as maternal medicine tries to move away from high rates of C-section, it's not uncommon even for a surrogate mom who is pregnant with one baby to be asked to deliver by cesarean section because this is more of just quality control. Labor delivery encourages maternal child bonding. And if we can do cesarean sections and remove babies right away, the understanding is perhaps this won't make the mother attached to that baby. Of course, there's just the psychological risk, as I said, about severing the maternal bond. We're denying the baby the colostrum and the breast milk and the benefit of breastfeeding and nursing. Nursing is a benefit to mothers. I mean, in postnatal care, one of the first things women do as they start breastfeeding is it helps contract the uterus, which has just been stretched out for 9 months and, labored and delivered the child. And that promotes, just the healing and the stopping of the bleeding post-delivery in the process of breastfeeding. So I think, again, back to my question, should public policy protect these young women who, like I said, are often young mothers of their own children at home and not be in the business of putting them at risk? So that's sort of the end of my remarks, and I'd be happy to stay on the phone for a few more minutes if there's questions that I might answer or explain further anything that I brought up.
Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate that. And any questions from members of the commission? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a couple questions about the last portion of your testimony. You mentioned that there are times that an egg that is put into the woman can split and become twins. What is the percentage rate of that happening?
It's not a very high percentage rate, but we just never know if and when it could happen. I mean, I live in California, and you probably are all very familiar with the case of Octomom, who delivered the eight babies. In the case of Octomom, five embryos were transferred, and then because of the natural twinning of some of the embryos, she actually ended up, delivering eight babies. It doesn't happen very often, but it certainly does happen. But again, you can't predict if and when it will happen.
Representative Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that explanation. So it's not common, but you can't predict or control it, you're saying.
Correct.
So it makes me think about then, is there any national or bi-state standard or law in place that limits how many eggs are implanted or put into the woman?
They implant embryos, not eggs.
I apologize.
No, that's fine. There's no, in the United States, there's no federal or state that limits the number of embryos that can be transferred. I mean, if you look at the practice in fertility medicine, the practice is moving away from transferring multiple embryos, but it's just a matter of professional conduct and professional practice. The procedure is called ESET, E-SET, or elective single embryo transfer. A lot of doctors, a lot of patients, a lot of couples prefer not to do it because, again, there's such a high failure rate, and these are very expensive technologies. And with each cycle that you either pay a surrogate mother to go through or a woman's doing it considerable amount of money. So in the spirit of efficiency and trying to get a live birth, even though the professional guidelines are moving to a model of elective single embryo transfer, a lot of people still opt to transfer two or three embryos in the hope that that there will be a live birth at the end.
One more question, Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would you say then if the transfer was limited to one egg, it would significantly reduce the risks to the mother and the child? Would that make a difference?
No, and I'm sorry, I'm going to be a stickler. It's one embryo.
Sorry.
In the case of a surrogate mother, she's still going to be at risk for the preeclampsia and the maternal hypertension because it's a foreign embryo. So it doesn't matter if you're putting in one or if you're putting in five or, you know, whatever. Her body is going to naturally see this as a foreign, you know, antibody, antigen, a foreign object that's been implanted into her. So, I mean, you will mitigate the risk of a high-order pregnancy, but you will not mitigate the risk of her rejecting this foreign object.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony, for joining us this morning, Ms. Lal. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, you know, our commission has been charged with, you know, if we come up with a policy for surrogacy, what that would look like, and what would be your recommendations if we had a policy as far as regulating the industry? What, in your experience, have you seen would be the most, and since you're a bioethicist, what are the most ethical laws that we could have to protect the mothers, the children, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, the $64,000 question here, because you're not going to be able to take away the health risk to these women and to the babies they're carrying. That's just a reality. So at what point will your policies feel that protections are in place when you can't remove the risk? You know, you could say, and I think perhaps something for consideration is don't allow the commerce. I mean, if you look what the country of India just did, they made all commercial surrogacy illegal under their, you know, their national law because they don't want people to be coerced in incentive to put their health at risk for money. I mean, why don't we allow organ donors in the United States to be paid? And there's a huge debate about why shouldn't we be able to pay, because we have this huge organ shortage and we have people dying on waiting lists. You know, while we're talking on the phone this morning, how many people will be on a waiting list waiting for an organ and will die? Well, we don't, as a matter of, you know, healthcare policy, we don't want people to assume risk for their own health and well-being because they need money. And this, you know, if you watch the proponents of surrogacy, when they start howling and making, you know, a lot of noise, when you start saying, well, we're going to take the money out of it, they'll say things like, well, women aren't going to do it then. Well, we don't change our organ donor policy because people aren't going to donate their organs. We encourage altruistic organ donation. So, you know, I don't know if I've answered your question, but I mean, I think one step would be to make it illegal to pay women to have babies for other people. New York State Task Force says, once you enter money into the equation, when their commission studied it, as you are, they said it cannot be distinguished from the buying and selling of children. And what is a surrogate mother being paid to do? To produce a baby that she will surrender at birth.
Thank you.
But there's no policy that's going to remove the health risk. There's nothing that the state of Minnesota can do that will protect maternal child health in the case of when things go wrong. Look at the case of Brooke Brown in Idaho. You know, what could the state of Idaho have done as a matter of law that would have prevented that?
Jennifer, or Ms. Lal, I have a question for you regarding data. Do you keep any data about the numbers of people that are successful, are not successful, whatever categories you think would be logical?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the sad things about the United States. I mean, the only place that's been tasked to collect any kind of data looking at this at a state-by-state and a federal lens is the Centers for Disease Control. But they don't track how many of these babies born every year through assisted reproductive technology are born through surrogate pregnancies. They only track how many IVF cycles are performed in the United States and how many live births and how many of those cycles performed every year in the U.S. are with donor eggs versus eggs from the mother. And if you look at the CDC data, I mean, and it hasn't changed for the last 7 or 8 years that I've been following the report, 75% of IVF cycles in the United States fail. And this, we're talking billions and billions of dollars being spent with a 75% failure rate, which is, I think, pretty significant. But nobody's tracking when babies are born in a labor and delivery hospital. Is this a surrogate baby or is this, not a surrogate baby? I mean, a birth certificate, and I don't know if this is how you track birth certificates in Minnesota. In my state, we recently changed it so it's parent A, parent B, parent C, parent D. We don't have mother or father listed anymore on our birth certificate, but most states still say mother and father, but the surrogate mother is not listed on the birth certificate. So you're not probably capturing how many surrogate pregnancies and what's the outcome of those pregnancies and the outcome of those babies in your own state. I mean, I think that would be something that perhaps your commission might want to ask some of your university hospitals there that are doing IVF and surrogate pregnancies and implantations. What Alan Merritt did at Loma Linda, what's going on in one particular hospital, how's that driving the economics and the length of hospital stays in Minnesota?
You bring up another question, a thought that I would like to get your response on. Is there any, when a surrogate, and we could talk to the surrogates, we've had some really good testimony from many surrogates, but when they are going to their doctor for their regular medication, what they have to do in order to keep their pregnancy, are they telling the doctor that it's a surrogate? I mean that it is a surrogate. They are a surrogate, or do they just go in for a pregnancy?
It could be both, either or. I'd like to make the point in the United States, one of the largest women populations targeted with surrogacy advertisement is military wives. And so a military wife perhaps might be impregnated by a fertility doctor, but then she sees the military doctor throughout the course of the pregnancy, and she might or might not be telling the doctor who's following her to the 9 months of the pregnancy for her, prenatal checkups that that's the case. I suspect probably not, because TRICARE might get kind of annoyed with paying for the health care of a military wife who's pregnant, as a surrogate. Sometimes these women will just be a high-risk person, like the women pregnant in California with triplets. Any woman who's carrying a triple pregnancy is almost instantly put into a category of the high-risk pregnancy, so she's going to be seeing perinatologists and neonatologists and, high-risk OBGYNs just because she's carrying a triple pregnancy. Chances are pretty high that those doctors taking care of that woman are going to know that she is a surrogate mom. But it's not always the case.
And thank you very much, Ms. Lal. And I want to say to the surrogates, if there are any here, I certainly will talk to you about it, and that we could have asked that question, but it just came up to me today to ask about it. And so that is something that I would like to know about. Any other questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell us what other countries or states or whatever have moved to just a single, either outlawed or gone just to an altruistic law where you do it for just to cover the medical costs. And of those, which ones had a policy allowing it and then they moved away from it? And, you know, are there, is there a theme of the reasons that they've moved away from it, or are there various reasons?
Yeah, you know, and again, I can't give you an exhaustive, you know, kind of landscape of the world and the global map as far as all this is changing almost daily. So I mentioned India recently passed laws that said, you know, this can only be for medical need. It can't be for social reasons or lifestyle choices. It's, you know, clearly surrogacy is only available for people that otherwise could not conceive because of a medical condition. They removed the money out of it. They made it, there's no transnational, you can't come from another country now to India. You must be an Indian citizen. You know, Germany, France, Sweden have always outlawed all surrogacy. It's just not allowed. I mean, I mentioned Brooke Brown was a surrogate for a couple in Spain. You know, all surrogacy is illegal in Spain, and I don't see that changing any time soon. So there's countries that it's just totally not allowed, and that's because of, you know, concerns about risks and harms and exploitation, and they don't want, you know, baby-making to become a contractual arrangement. Our neighbors in Canada, as a matter of federal policy, you know, unfortunately, I think their laws have way too many loopholes in it, but their law on the books in all of Canada is only altruistic, it's not commercial. But because there's a lot of leniency on what payment is, there's still, you know, the opportunity to be paid as a surrogate, even though the law says it's only for altruistic reasons. So Thailand, as a country that's recently closing down their borders. You see a lot of countries closing their borders. They don't want this trafficking and transnational, you know, baby trade happening on the global market. And a lot of that's come from just harm done to women, knowing that it's wealthy people that can afford to buy, and lower income, or in the case of third world countries, truly destitute women that, you know, need this as a way of just, you know, being able to be part of the economy in their countries and put food on their table. So it's everything from, you know, risk of exploitation and harm and corruption as far as medical harm.
Thank you, Ms. Law. Did you have a follow-up? Someone? Okay. Mr. Simmons.
Ms. Lala, on that subject, there are several states in the United States that have surrogacy statutes that limit compensation for carriers. Have you dealt with any of those states, and do you have any observations of how that policy is working?
Yeah, I think maybe perhaps the best state right now, just to make an illustration, would be New York State. You know, New York State, right after the very famous Baby Ann Mary Beth Whitehead case, convened a task force. They met and deliberated like you are doing, developed the policy. So the current state law in New York is for only altruistic surrogacy. Now, there's been legislation introduced in New York State saying that we need to be able to pay women because women otherwise aren't going to do a 9-month pregnancy just because they're a nice person. You know, it's an onerous, quite a, you know, being pregnant for 9 months is a lot of work. And so there is a push right now to undo that, but so far that hasn't happened. But, you know, that's sort of the argument. If we can't pay women to do this, how else are we going to do this? You know, there's a whole debate on, is this work? Are we just paying a woman to do a job? And so we need to compensate her for 9 months worth of work. And, you know, I don't see pregnancy as work. I don't see pregnancy as a job that somebody hires somebody to do. You know, I don't know what's going to happen in New York State, but that's a classic example of a state that has no compensation currently on the books, but there's agitation and noise, you know, to remove that and to make it so women can be paid.
Thank you. Ms. Lal has been very informative, and I appreciate your taking the time to give us some information on this topic. So with that.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble, did you have a... Oh, okay. So then our agenda lists Dorinda Bordley. She is not able to be here, but Mr. Nick Nikas is going to speak to us again in place of Dorinda Bordley. Mr. Nikas, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Welcome to our commission. Yes.
Great. Yes, I just wanted to say Dorinda's daughter had a medical issue. She was not able to testify. She is the expert. So what I'm going to share with you is what she would have said, but I'm sure she would have said it much more effectively.
And your title is president, Mr. Nick?
Planned like Jennifer Lawless presented, except I understand that Dorinda was asked, that the argument for gestational surrogacy, one of the arguments is that it's a very private decision and doesn't affect other people. Dorinda pondered that question and asked in a surrogacy arrangement, who are the individuals who could be involved? So the list that she came up with that I'm going to present to you, I'm not saying that this is in every surrogacy or even in most surrogacies, but this is the kind of industry that has potentially sprung up. First, you will have surrogacy brokers to advertise and screen gamete donors, egg and sperm donors, and also brokers to unite surrogate mothers with intended parents. You'll have individuals who may do a criminal background check, whether they have law enforcement experience or current law enforcement or just private investigators. You can have lawyers involved to draft surrogacy agreements. You can have people in the financial industry, bankers, whatever, to handle escrow accounts for payments involved in the surrogacy arrangement. You obviously have fertility doctors to do the IVF and then the embryo transfer. Some of the agreements that we've looked at suggest that the women who are surrogate mothers during the 9 months of pregnancy see counselors and attend support groups, so you have those individuals. You obviously have obstetricians and gynecologists to monitor the high-risk pregnancy that Jennifer mentioned for the surrogate mother while she's pregnant. You can potentially have physicians to terminate the pregnancy or reduce the multiples, and Jennifer mentioned that. You possibly have insurance agents involved to issue policies because some of the contracts talk about will pay you so much in the event of surrogate death or loss of reproductive organs or capabilities, so you have that potential. If there are disputes that go to litigation, you can have family lawyers and judges involved. And then you can have media in high-profile disputes who are involved. One example of that was a case that, and you can look it up, I think it's still on the website, CNN Health website, dated March 6, 2013. The senior medical correspondent was Elizabeth Cohen, and the title of the article was Surrogate Offered $10,000 to Abort Baby. This was a case that got media coverage because while she was going through the pregnancy, she was required by contract to have monthly visits, as any pregnant woman would normally do. Sometime during that process, the physician thought that the child she was carrying had some disabilities. The intended parents decided they did not want a child with disabilities. And then, according to the terms of the contract, if I understand this right, you can double check what I'm telling you. She was, the intended parent said, under the provisions of the contract, please abort this child. We'll try again. We don't want a disabled child. She was not willing to do that. And this got coverage. And then the baby was born with a cleft lip and some other disabilities. I don't know the whole story, but the point is that media can be involved. So while it is presented as a private decision, there are potentially a number of players taken out of just one woman and her physician. And I think that's all I have, and I think Dorinda was going to present, but I'll try to answer any questions, although, like I said, Dorinda's the expert in this.
Thank you, Mr. Nikas. Representative Scott has a question for you.
Yes, Mr. Nickus, if you could just go over your position with your organization and do a little, just give us a little background on yourself, and then I'm going to start asking this to everyone that testifies. You know, if we regulate this industry in the state of Minnesota, what are some things that we definitely need to consider and include in any regulation that we have?
Sure. And understand that, again, Dorinda is the expert on this, and unfortunately, I'm subbing for her.
Sure.
I'm an attorney, a co-founder of the Bioethics Firm. We're a public interest law firm. We do bioethics law, which means we do law that's at the intersection of law, science, medicine, and morality, trying to determine issues like this. Our biggest problem is bioethics defense. Biggest problem with gestational surrogacy, in addition to all the medical concerns that Jennifer mentioned, would be we think this is a commodification of women and children. This can lead to embryo or baby trafficking. Dorinda coined the term reproductive trafficking. This is inherent with this process where a woman carries a baby and hands it over. Besides the serious health risk, we also are concerned that no matter how you try to regulate it, there's an inability to give fully informed consent prior to pregnancy and childbirth. Now, again, Dorinda would do a better job with this, but my understanding is in almost every state, the woman has a child and she intends to give the child up for adoption after birth, that there is a required waiting period where the mother has to look at this baby who is now before her and decide whether she can part with it. And my understanding is that that is not required in any state with respect to surrogacy. There is just simply give birth, hand the child to the intended parents, and then finish the contractual obligation, whatever payment you get. But even if you could regulate that, there just seems to be an inherent commodification of women and children in this process. And the reproductive trafficking that we're concerned about. So we would probably be more of a, say, a country like Spain and think that for whatever reasons, this is not a practice that benefits society overall.
Representative Scott, do you have a...
That's right for
okay.
Now.
I'm wondering, Mr. Nickus, if you could maybe ask Dorinda Boardley to respond to the question that Representative Scott put forward in saying, what would she, since you said she's the expert, that maybe she might be able to respond to that question in writing to us.
I will present her. I don't know how long her daughter's medical situation is going
right.
to last, but I would think that she would say pretty much what I said, although she might articulate it much more.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And deeply, but I'm happy to pass that request along.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question. You mentioned something about insurance. Would you think it would be helpful, as Representative Scott was asking about potential policy that we would put in place to require that health insurance would cover any potential, costs or if something went wrong with the pregnancy, that sort of thing?
Well, I'm not sure. I guess if the question is, would regulating this limit the harms? Some of the harms, I think, are inherent, and so no regulation would allow it. I mentioned insurance simply to say that, along with all the other people involved in this process, potentially, you would also have insurance agents, because at least one of the contracts that we looked at talked about, that if the surrogate died, there was a certain payment. If the surrogate lost reproductive organs or capabilities, there was a certain payment, which we assumed was supported by some insurance policy.
that, are you finished, Representative Wills?
More.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much for your willingness to step in for Dorinda, and I appreciate your time spent.
Yes, and I'll pass your request on to her as soon as I talk to her. I think she's with her daughter now, so I don't know what that will be.
We're not expecting something.
She needs to get back to specifically.
If she could, probably to who? Okay, we'll send it to Sally, our administrative aide, will make sure that you have the address for the person to that you'll send it to. So she'll make sure of that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we have, is there somebody? No? Okay. Brian Shelton. From the Colorado Center for Reproductive Medicine.
Hi there, Madam Chair. Where would you like for me to sit?
You have to sit way back there. It's the only way we can do it. So if you will speak up. This is not microphone. I mean, it is for recording only. It doesn't make your voice heard better.
Fantastic.
So you have to speak loud and clear and not too fast.
Got it. Good morning, Madam Chair and other members of the Commission. Thank you for allowing me to address you all today. My name is Brian Shelton, and I am the Chief Operating Officer for CCRM. CCRM was founded some 25 years ago by one of the infertility specialist pioneers, Dr. William Schoolcraft, and offers its patients some of the highest pregnancy rates across the nation, including Minnesota. Infertility is not an inconvenience. The Centers for Disease Control characterizes it as a disease of the reproductive system that impairs the body's ability to perform the basic functions of reproduction. Nationally, over 12% or 7.5 million women of childbearing age, 15 to 44 years, are affected by infertility, which is typically diagnosed after not becoming pregnant from 12 consecutive months of unprotected sex with their partner. Here, that equates to more than 675,000 Minnesota William. It is also noteworthy to add that in approximately 40% of infertile couples, the male partner is either the sole cause or a contributing cause of the infertility. CCRM Minneapolis began serving its patients with infertility in June of 2015. This new facility is an all-inclusive center with an on-site clinic, surgery center, IVF laboratory, and clinical laboratory. CCRM's reputation for pregnancy success has attracted patients to Colorado from all across the nation and many parts of the globe for years. It is why we are here in Minneapolis today, so that we can create easier access to the same care and same success. CCRM Minneapolis is a busy clinic, seeing nearly 60 patients per month and treating some 30 women at any given time. Patients come to us by way of referral from OBGYNs, other medical specialists, friends and family, as well as from their own research of publicly reported outcomes. CCRM Minneapolis's reputable results are accredited to its proprietary science and treatment protocols, as well as its adherence to rigorous regulatory standards. All physicians and clinical staff are subject to their respective licensure board oversight and must fulfill all CCRM credentialing requirements. Our president and medical director, Dr. April Batchelor, is board certified in obstetrics and gynecology and board eligible in reproductive endocrinology. She holds a Minnesota State Physician license and DEA certificate. She is a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and is a member of several infertility-focused organizations. Since 2015, Dr. Batchelor is an assistant professor and residency site director for the University of Minnesota. The nursing team holds Minnesota State licenses and is certified in basic and advanced life-supporting techniques, CPR. The IVF embryology lab director is Dr. Jason Swain, who is internationally recognized for improving embryo culture. He is certified by the American Board of Bioanalysis and is a high-complexity laboratory director. The clinical laboratory is certified by the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, known as CLIA, a federal law which subjects our lab to federal regulation and inspection. The IVF and clinical laboratories are accredited by the College of American Pathologists, CAP, and must meet CAP standards to maintain this accreditation. The surgery center is licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health and is accredited by the American Association for Accreditation of Ambulatory Surgery Facilities, also known as QUAD-ASF. QUAD-ASF is similar to the Joint Commission, the National Accreditation Organization for Hospitals, and like hospitals, subjects us to rigorous reviews and inspections. Furthermore, the clinic observes federal oversight from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, because of its handling of reproductive human tissue, eggs and sperm. In fact, the FDA completed an unannounced inspection of our clinic last week, and we were found to be 100% compliant with all federal standards. Finally, our pregnancy outcomes are reported to the Centers for Disease Control and the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, SART. SART is the primary organization of professionals dedicated to the practice of assisted reproductive technologies in the United States. CCRM actively supports and promotes SART guidelines. In short, our clinic is one of the most highly regulated entities in Minnesota, subject to state, federal, and professional standard requirements. I'd also like to add that other clinics here in the state could not be present today, but did submit written comments, which I believe are in your packet for reference. That concludes my prepared remarks at this point. I'm willing to take questions at this time.
Representative, first of all, let me ask you, do we have do we have the packet? Okay, and okay, Representative Scott
Has a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today. Could we get a copy of the federal standards that you mentioned for the inspections and whatever? I don't.
For the FDA requirements?
Yes,
we can provide that.
Right, thank you. And a previous testifier testified to this, and I've also read it in some information that Mr. Cassidy, who was the attorney in the Baby M case, was here a few weeks ago, and he left some additional information, which, by the way, I need to remind members is on the website now for the commission. I would encourage you to read the testimony of some of the other folks there, particularly the physicians that talk about the risks, health risks to the mother, and they're wider than just what was expressed here today. But I know that the use of Lupron, does your agency or your organization use Lupron?
We do.
Okay. And I know that that is not labeled for use for reproductive purposes like this. And I'm wondering, since you're in this field, what does the FDA, they don't come down on people for using drugs in ways that they're not labeled for? Is that accurate?
I can't comment exactly. I have a colleague here, Monica, I don't know if you can elaborate on that point for us.
Lupron is not, the drugs are not one of the things that the FDA looks at. They look at our testing and our screening processes.
Maybe we could get that on record, then it would be good if you want to step up to the table.
Sure.
And any place on the table in front of a microphone is fine.
Lupron is just one of the drugs that we use in fertility, just one, and it's not used in every case. Some people who choose not to be on it don't use it. And there's many, many drugs, a couple of them that aren't approved by the FDA, but are approved for uses in other conditions. So,
does that answer your question,
yeah,
Representative Scott?
One, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for that answer. So I know the ASRM and SART, these organizations have their standards. What is done to ensure compliance, and then what, if anything, happens if you don't comply?
So from
being non-compliance.
From a compliance standpoint, our organization has adopted that and promotes it across all of our locations.
So you're self-regulating.
We are self-regulating in that regard with adherence to those standards.
And so there's really no consequence if you're non-compliant with your own standards.
Well, from a standpoint of the information that, you know, patients would seek out about, you know, their individual doctor and whether they're participating with SART or ASRM would give an indication of the quality of physician that they're seeing.
Okay. Question?
question, Madam Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Do you collect any data? You know, data is king around here in the world that we live in. And particularly in making decisions like this as policymakers, data is really important. Do you collect any data and keep any data on some of the outcomes and some of the data on both the surrogate and the intended parents? Is that something that you keep track of at all in any way?
I'll comment and then you can add. We do track a number of different items month to month across each of our clinics and benchmark those results accordingly so that we understand how our, you know, the quality of our outcomes. One metric I'll call out because it was referenced in another testimony has to do with the number of embryos we transfer. So ASRM gives guidance on the number of embryos to be transferred. We adhere strictly to that, and here in Minnesota, our average is one. So in terms of multiple pregnancies, that is an issue that we take out of the equation when we're dealing with individuals who are pursuing surrogacy.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you. What are there other metrics that you keep track of?
Yes, we track pregnancy results across different age categories. We track the quality of our embryos. We track the conversion rate of embryos through their development over 6 days. We also track, what else can you add to that?
We would definitely be tracking adverse outcomes. We're a new clinic, so at this point in time, we don't have any, thank goodness. So also in response to one of the questions that you asked the first speaker, you asked about what the percentage rate of monozygotic twinning was or identical twinning where an embryo splits. That statistic is less than 1%.
Are you willing to share any of the data that you collect?
Yes, we can.
Commission?
It's publicly, I mean, we publicly report it to the CDC and SART, so we're happy to share it to this commission as well.
Okay. I would like to see that.
I think I would share Representative Scott's statement that data is very important, and the more we can get, and it's certainly one of my primary issues that I'm thinking about during this, and brings me to the another question on data, and that is, you know, as we all know of the many good things that have happened with surrogacies, so do you have data on things that didn't work out very well for either the intended parent or the surrogate or the child? Do you keep any data on that?
I don't know any off the top of my head. I will have to check with our quality improvement director in that area to see if we have results that can be shared. Or that we've tracked.
And I just want to say that it would seem to me that there has to be some, and we know there is because it's in the newspapers and the courts and so forth, but to hear about why did something happen that was wrong and that we could know about so that it would be something that we would try to address.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I have several questions here. Tell me a little bit about in the contracts. Well, first of all, are you kind of the middle person, or do you also do contracts for surrogacy?
We observe altruistic surrogacy. So in terms of contracts, do you want to comment on that?
Our patients, our intended parents, are required to have a legal agreement. Separate legal counsel between the gestational carrier and the intended parents, and they seek that out themselves and then provide us documentation that the legal contract exists.
So you're not party to what goes into that contract?
We are not.
No.
Okay. But have you read them?
Over the years, I've read a couple of them. You know, basically it's addressing parentage and compensation, if there is any, and like Mr. Shelton said that most of our clients or our customers that we have, our patients, are in altruistic situations.
Okay. Is it strictly a matter of the contract, or does your company require psychological testing of both the surrogate and the intended parents?
We do.
Okay. Tell me what your policy is on that.
Our policy is that the intended parents meet with the psychologist and have a consultation and obtain psychological clearance. Our gestational carriers also attend and meet with a psychologist, as does their partner if they're partnered. And then the couples together also meet with a psychologist all together.
And Madam Chair, who recommends the psychologist? Are they free to choose their own, or is that something you would give referrals for? And then what type of questions are asked? Do you have a protocol of questions, so to speak, that they must answer to satisfy your requirements?
We do provide counselors and references to counselors that are familiar with our process. In terms of the questionnaire that they use, I'm not familiar with what that is.
I don't know all of the content of their questionnaire.
Okay. And so you provide some counselors yourself.
We
so
do.
You pay those folks.
Correct.
And I don't want to accuse you of anything, but I want to make sure that those counselors don't have an incentive to approve people because they're paid by you.
Correct. No, they are not incentivized to, if you will, convince the patient to move forward with a decision that would take them down surrogacy if they're not fully prepared to do so. We're about couples, families achieving their dreams of having children, but it is a voluntary choice for them to pursue that. We aid them with all the information, experience that they will go through, informed consents, risks, et cetera, that they will encounter along the way, but it's their choice through and through.
And do you work internationally?
We have one location in Toronto, Canada.
Yeah, okay. That's all for now. I have more questions, but go ahead. Let somebody else ask.
Any other questions from members? Mr. Stebbins.
Just follow up. The counselors that you do use, do you have minimum credentials that you require for the counselors that are discussing these issues with parents or the surrogate?
Yeah, they're meeting, you know, typical counselor standards, licensed or medical credentialed counselors in their given state.
If I could.
Oh, yes. Is this Senator Benson?
Yes, it is. Thank
okay.
you. In all the data that's tracked, is there any tracking of babies born before 39 weeks and, you know, at what point these babies are born? Minnesota's been working really hard on babies not being born before 39 weeks, and so I was wondering if our testifier tracked that kind of information.
We do not. We monitor the patient through about 12 weeks of their pregnancy, and then they're referred back to their OBGYN for the remainder of the care of their pregnancy. Now, we do follow up with the physicians of record for that particular patient to find out the outcome of the birth, but in terms of time of birth and et cetera, that's not something that I'm aware we track.
No, I believe that's tracked through the Minnesota Department of Health.
Well, we have somebody here from the Minnesota Department of Health.
Do you have a comment for that, Mr. Pollack?
Yes, the Department of Health does track it, but I don't know if they track
they would know for some surrogacy.
Non-traditional or fertility assisted. I don't know if they differentiate.
Mr. Pollack.
I don't know, Madam Chair. And I think Senator Benson is right that our the births data system that we have would track birth defects, but it wouldn't necessarily identify a pregnancy that was the result of surrogacy or IVF. But I can follow up on that.
Thank you.
Another question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Does your agency limit the number of times a woman can be a surrogate?
We do not. Their primary medical doctor provides clearance before any surrogate gestational carrier comes to us. They're required to have medical clearance. And for us, in my experience at CCRM so far, again, we're new, the gestational carriers that are carrying for our intended parents are family members typically, family and friends. So they're not doing this repeatedly. They're doing it one time to help someone that's close to them.
And so I always have to ask this question, too.
Yes, go right ahead. That's a good question.
How much does your agent or your company make per surrogate? I'm sure it probably varies, but if you could give us a range.
We're not charging the surrogate, per se. If there's a financial arrangement, it's outside of what we do. In terms of a cycle cost with us for IVF treatment, both our fees plus medications that the patient would have to take runs in the neighborhood of around $20,000 per cycle.
Okay, thank you.
I have another question, and I'll put it forward, and maybe it wouldn't be you would not be the right person to respond. Would you consider, regarding altruistic and only for medical reasons that someone couldn't have a baby, what about, would same-sex couples fit that category then, that could be a reason why you would be having a surrogate?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The insurance question is still nagging at me, and I was wondering, for your business, do you take insurance? What typically is allowed to be covered by insurance?
So I'll address it from a national perspective and then bring it back to Minnesota. So nationally, we do accept insurance in different markets where there are covered benefits provided by the insurance carriers. And it ranges from very basic treatment to full IVF coverage, okay? So we accept it where it makes sense from an economical standpoint. Here in Minnesota, we are not contracted but actively pursuing to be in network with payers for here in the state.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you think that this should be covered by insurance in case something went wrong to help protect the woman carrying the child or the child?
So I answered your question initially in terms of infertility benefits. So if there was an unusual outcome associated with that, then their medical insurance would make a determination as to what's covered or not. I would say that from my standpoint, increasing access of care on the infertility side, we support and we see that growing from state to state, which is why we are looking to be in network with all payers. That being said, I think the other question is in terms of mandating coverage for outcomes related to surrogacy. I think that's where you get into an interesting question with employer-sponsored plans and the benefits they're willing to provide to the members of their organization. And I don't have a position on that.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. Mr. Sheldon.
Thank you.
And I didn't get your name, and I would like that.
Monica McKinnon.
You're Monica.
I am.
You're our next.
Yeah.
She's next.
Yep.
Testifier. Okay. I didn't catch that. So thank you, Mr. Sheldon.
Thank you.
Monica McKinnon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Commission for allowing us to present testimony today. I'm a registered nurse and the third-party coordinator at CCRM Minneapolis, representing Dr. April Batchelor and the Colorado Center for Reproductive Medicine. I've spent the last 37 years working as a nurse in various women's health settings, primarily in labor and delivery. For the last 5 years, I've had the great privilege to work with some of the very best physician scientists in the field of reproductive medicine. 2 weeks ago, I attended this session as an observer, listening to the testimony of attorneys, agencies, and educators. As I listened to each professional speak, I found myself thinking, what would I say when I stood before you or sat before you? It became clear to me as I listened that as a healthcare professional advocating for patients and as a nurse with a passion for life and birth, my goal today would be to give the term gestational carrier and the people who need it a face. At CCRM and other fertility centers in the Twin Cities and beyond, we are in the business of creating families. We take it one step further by using science, technology, and the skills of many professionals to create life for couples and individuals who can't, for various reasons, make that happen in the usual way. The scenarios of people who come to us seeking help to create their families are innumerable. I would like to give you just a few real-life examples. The names have been changed, but the stories are real. Scenario one, Brent and Heather are young urban professionals in their late 20s. They have one child, a son, who is 3 years old. He was born via a vaginal delivery. However, Heather experienced a severe post-delivery hemorrhage. In order to save her life, doctors performed a hysterectomy. They come to us now, hoping to have another child of their own using a gestational carrier. Heather's sister, Gina, has agreed to carry and deliver her sister and brother-in-law's baby. Scenario two, Jeff and Jessica have been trying to have a baby for several years. Jessica has become pregnant 4 times, but each time, at approximately 6 weeks gestation, Jessica has miscarried. The emotional toll of recurrent pregnancy loss has devastated them, but they still long to be parents. Diagnostic testing reveals that Jessica's uterus is only 3 centimeters by 3 centimeters. The normal uterus is 7.6 centimeters long by 4.6 centimeters in width. This discovery explains that while Jessica has no problem getting pregnant, her uterus cannot anatomically sustain a pregnancy. They need a gestational carrier or a surrogate. Like Heather, Jessica's sister has generously offered to carry their child. Scenario three, Brian and Kelly have been married for 5 years. Busy with their careers, they waited to have a child. Just when they decided to try, Kelly was diagnosed with an illness requiring medication that's contraindicated in pregnancy. While Kelly's disease is manageable, stopping the medication during pregnancy is not an option. Their dream of becoming parents can only happen with a gestational carrier. Kelly's sister-in-law has volunteered to carry their child. And finally, scenario four. John and Bill are a married same-sex couple. They come to us seeking assistance in helping them create the family that they hope for. Their needs are a bit more complicated. Not only do they need a gestational carrier, they also need donor eggs. They are working with an agency to find their carrier and plan to use a donor from our anonymous donor egg program. Each one of these couples and couples like them present to CCRM and clinics across the country seeking help with what many of us take for granted. Like us, they want a family, but they can't do it without help, and we have the ability to help them. Our goal as a clinic from that point on becomes assisting them in the best interests, health, and safety of all parties involved. In doing so, CCRM has clearly defined policies and protocols for testing and screening both the intended parents and the gestational carrier. Because we are transferring tissue in the form of an embryo into a gestational carrier, we are responsible for meeting the requirements of the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA's ultimate goal is the prevention of communicable disease, and our practices support that, and not only do we comply with that, but we go beyond. How do we do that? The FDA's requirements in a GC situation or a gestational carrier situation require testing and screening of the intended parents, as it's their tissue that will be transferred into another person. They do not require that the gestational carrier be tested and screened, but we do it anyway because it's good practice. Additionally, we also require that the gestational carrier's partner be tested for communicable disease. Would we have to do this? No. But as I said, it's good, safe practice. That said, while we as a clinic support regulation and standardization from clinic to clinic and agency to agency, removing the option of gestational carriers from bearing children for others would be a devastating loss for our patients and for Minnesota as a state who claims to support families of all kinds. In closing, I would like to again thank the Commission for your interest in the clinic's perspective. As I mentioned, I spent greater than 20 years watching and assisting in childbirth as a labor and delivery nurse. Many of the parents that I was with at the bedside were elated to become parents. Some of them were not. The last 5 years, I've had the great privilege of assisting many wonderful people who, with every fiber of their being, long to be parents. Their children are hoped for and wanted. I am incredibly proud to be part of a practice that's dedicated to making their dreams come true.
The first question that I have for you is a simple one, and that is, where was this meeting that you attended that was so... Tell me a little bit about it, the name of it, and who sponsored it.
The meeting?
You said you went to some event where you talked to, listened to all kinds of people.
It was here.
It was us.
She came to this hearing and sat in on one of our hearings.
I was here.
Oh, I
it was you guys.
Was you went to, I thought you went to some great and mighty.
No.
Maybe that's what we are.
I was here 2 weeks ago. Yes.
Okay. That was. Okay. Any questions for Monica?
I guess I'll ask a question. Does your organization do reductions?
We do not do selective reduction at our clinic.
Thank you.
To that point, did I remember that Mr. Shelton said something about you only use one embryo? Or?
The American Society for Reproductive Medicine, which is kind of the umbrella that gives best practice recommendations to fertility centers literally around the world, their recommendation is for ESET, or elective single embryo transfer, and that is what we practice.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. When you find out that one of the embryos has indeed implanted, and so the woman is pregnant,
mm-hmm.
who's the first, does the surrogate know before the intended parents?
They know at the same time. They're all told at the same time. So, and part of my role as a third-party coordinator is that communication. Typically, if someone's pregnant, the first contact comes from Dr. Batchelor.
And when you're trying to match the surrogates and the intended parents, that's part of your role, correct?
We do not match the intended parents with the surrogate because typically in the scenarios that I described, their family members. They've found them themselves, or someone's come forward in their family or relationships that said, I will carry your baby for you. If it's an agency-acquired surrogate, then the agencies are working with the intended parents to find that person.
All right.
Mr. Stebbins.
In your observations, ma'am, have you come across situations where you find reluctant surrogates or surrogates who may be lacking in the informed consent part of anything they're doing?
I have not. Part of our process at the clinic, when someone initially agrees to become a carrier, they come in, they meet with me, we sign consents, we discuss the process, we discuss what that involves, what the expectations are, what medications they would be on, and we basically... It's a process in education for everyone, from the intended parents to the gestational carrier. You know, we outline what are the requirements, that they need to see a psychologist, that they need to initiate a legal agreement. They need to come to us, the gestational carrier, with clearance from their primary medical doctor that says that they are in good health and able to carry a child. So all of those are requirements before we even get out of the gate.
Would we be able to get a copy of your consent forms?
I can check with Dr. Batchelor, Brian.
Thank you.
Again, you would send them to Sally. Or... Any other questions? If not, I thank you very much. And at this time, I'd like to see if there is anyone in the audience that would care to make some statement or ask a question. Since we do have some time.
You're good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I'd like to make a statement.
Okay. If you would step forward. And identify yourself and.
Sure.
We don't mind, you know, adjourning early.
No, no, I won't. I won't.
I don't want to be the person between you and lunch. I will try, no. And I will keep it short. I just wanted to highlight a few things.
Your name?
My name is Julie Berman. I am somebody who went through infertility. I did not, using a gestational carrier was not part of my personal journey, but I was deeply touched by that experience, and therefore I volunteer for Resolve, the National Infertility Association. I currently serve as the chair of the board of that organization, and we exist to help people who are struggling to build their families, whether they do that with medical treatment, through adoption, or they end their quest to become parents. So that's just kind of who I am. I just wanted to point out that in your packets, there are several other clinics in Minnesota who wanted to be here today and couldn't. And so there are three letters here from some of those clinics. Of the five clinics, I think you've heard from probably four with the letters, three or four. And I just wanted to highlight one thing in one of these because you asked a question about it. You had asked about, you know, bad outcomes or things that had happened. And one of the clinics here in town, Center for Reproductive Medicine, there's a letter from Dr. Bruce Campbell, who runs that group. And he's been there for a long time. And he says, towards the end, in the 23 years we have been performing these cycles, I cannot recall a situation that has caused me to question whether this therapy should be available. So I just wanted to point that out because that was one of the questions you asked. Another question that maybe we can get some answers at a future meeting, I know there's been a lot of questions about Lupron. I will tell you, I, as a patient, took Lupron as part of my infertility journey. And my understanding is there are many FDA-approved medications that are used in ways that aren't approval, maybe off-label ways, in many different kinds of medical ways. So I'm hoping we can have somebody at a future. I'm not an expert on that. I can't really speak to it, but I'm hoping somebody in the future can address that issue because it's obviously a concern. So I just wanted to share those 2 points. I'm open to any questions. I am not a doctor. I can't speak from the medical point of view, but happy to share anything.
And we do have have the letters from Dr. Bruce Campbell and Dr. Colleen Casey.
Good. And there's one more from Dr. Randall Korfman.
Yes, I do have Randall Korfman here, too. So we do have letters. And I was remiss, I should have mentioned the letters that were put into our packets.
Okay.
Everyone has them. And if anybody else wants one from the audience, we could get copies made. So thank you, Julie.
Yep.
Any questions for Julie or any comments from members?
Madam Chair, if we have extra time, could we discuss the work plan? I'd raised some questions at the last meeting, and now
certainly.
That we have both chairs here, maybe it would be a better time.
First of all, let me just ask if there's anyone else in the audience that wishes to make any comments or suggestions. Okay, Mr. Pollack.
So the work plan, as I understand it, has us meeting on September 27th and October 11th to discuss some additional legal policy issues. And then October 25th, then for meeting number 8 to discuss other jurisdictions. And then for meeting 9 on November 10th to, I guess, determine if there'll be a majority and minority report. I would just propose to the commission that we move up that determination to the October meeting or have some kind of document to respond to at the October meeting to give staff and perhaps whatever the majority or minority group, both maybe, you know, however you want to approach it as chairs, there could be multiple or different majorities and minorities on different policy statements or different mm-hmm. aspects of this. I just think it would be useful to have a little bit more time. If we wait until November 10th, to even determine if there's a majority and minority report, that's about, you know, less than a month with Thanksgiving for the staff to actually put something together. So that would be my proposal, would be to move some of the meeting 9 agenda items into meeting 8 to give more time.
And if I recall, and some of the staff people can help me, but there's one thing that I really am interested in, and that is to hear from former Representative Kathy Tingelstedt as the author of the Surrogacy Bill back in 2002. We would be trying to get both the Senate and the House authors here to talk about what is good about their bill, what was liked and kind of accepted by everyone, and what was caused the problems. So if we could move, I will say that I want that done before we start our real work group and putting our report together. But I appreciate your comments, and Peggy, make sure that you have your say here too. But the time goes so fast, and I think your suggestion is good, Mr. Pollack. If we can work it out, maybe Sally and Marie, maybe you could, and others, Kathy, could talk about moving that up so that we'd get started earlier. And you got to give me your name, Koppel, Jim, James. Mr. Koppel.
Yes, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, too, as we listen, and we haven't really had conversations, we're just taking in, learning. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm sure all of us have thoughts as we're listening to the testimony and the callers. And I just wonder if it's constructive not to state positions, but to try to segment this at some point into pieces. And I don't mean it to strategize at all. I'm trying to think of it as like a learning experience that, you know, it would be certainly a lot has to do with the idea of surrogacy. I mean, that's why we're here. But there's a lot of other issues that have come up, medical issues, et cetera. And I'm trying to think of how we could potentially, some of them don't apply to surrogacy, they apply to any infertility treatment. And it seems like that's, carries with it certain risks, you know, multiple births, all of those issues that we talk about. And it would be helpful to kind of structure this in a way where we would be looking more at the issues of surrogacy as opposed to the issues of infertility, if you're following, you know, and not to, I'm not, and maybe that's not right, but I'm trying to figure out a way to move this forward in a really constructive way, an educational way, because I think this report can be very educational as well, regardless of majority, minority. But it would seem helpful to me to try to delineate where surrogacy picks up, you know, and what are the issues unique to surrogacy, because I think otherwise we end up with a really broad topic. Mm-hmm. And we might be saying things about surrogacy that really have carry greater weight than just surrogacy. So I wonder if we might entertain just a pathway for us to be thinking about this and digesting it that would contribute to a better conversation later.
Right. I think that in drafting the reports, design we come up with for that, I think the reports have to be focused on surrogacy. And obviously one of the primary differences with surrogacy versus any other infertility is that you're asking another person to be involved. Mm-hmm. It's several people from what this sure. person said today, from lawyers and criminal background check. I mean, he had quite a list. So I think that's one of the big delineations, but I think that we can do that in the reports and keep it focused on the issue of surrogacy from a legal standpoint, from a medical standpoint, all those things, the informed consent. That's why I wanted to see a copy of that informed consent, because as the previous testifiers on the phone today said, you know, there can never really be complete informed consent when you have a third party, and the risks, the medical risks are always inherent. But anyway, I see what you're saying, but I think that we can narrow that down in the reports, and whoever is tasked with that can certainly focus on that alone. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So I don't know if that was if that's an adequate answer for you or not, Mr. Koppel.
Mr. Koppel, and all of us, I think, are kind of thinking about we're getting ready to start. We're going to have to face the facts that the time is closing in on us, so we have to start somewhere. And I know that I've talked to the staff people here and saying that I want to get together with Representative Scott and myself and maybe a couple of other people that, if you're interested, to kind of start talking about how we start framing something up. Just beginning, not making decisions, but listening to what people are saying. And it could be something that any member of, or all of the members of the commission, could make some sort of recommendations that we could just kind of look around and see what people are thinking and finding out the best thoughts and ideas. So I would say that we could start. I know I have been kind of tracking things that have meaning to me, and I'm sure many of you have different things that you're going to bring up and that we need to hear them and be ready to talk about it. But like at each meeting, to see what came out that might be something that we would want to work out in a more larger site. So we are planning to do that, right, Peggy?
Yes.
You and I, yep. and others.
Some of us are running for re-election. Others aren't.
I know, and that's why I've got three of these sort of meetings going on. But I'm happy. Definitely, this is an important one for me. Mr. Pollack.
Just to follow up on the earlier question from Senator Benson, MDH staff does not track the type of method used for conception in any of our birth defect or like the pregnancy data system. That would only be what's already been discussed on the birth certificate.
Kind of figured that. I don't think she's on there anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe
so. She hung up.
Well, we can tell her that, though. With that, I think that we're set. We don't have anything ready to say that we're ready to start a meeting, but the one thing that I would say that we will be doing that, and I do really want to make sure that Representative Fingolstadt and Senator Higgins, if they're able to come and be with us, that would be important for me. With that, any other comments? Go ahead. Nope, I didn't say it. I said meeting. That's
again,
all.
I just encourage members to look at the website and read all the other information there. I know it's a lot of reading. I think if we had a piece of paper for every document that's been given to us, it would probably be a really super tall stack. But
I do have a super tall stack. Though, so
yeah. I like to print things off. I like to keep the paper industry in Minnesota alive and healthy. I just like having a paper document. But so I have stacks around my house. But yeah, I encourage you to look at some of those documents. I think the ones of particular interest to me were the medical professionals. There's Dr. Caruso and then a couple of others, but very enlightening information.
Thank you. Meeting adjourned.